the Lord. If you've ever gone to a farmer's market, when you go to a farmer's market, you will meet with all kinds of vendors. One may be selling you some craftsmanship that they have prepared themselves, and the next person might be selling you honey or maple syrup, and on it goes. You go from vendor to vendor. And when you go to a farmer's market, they're all packed together. And you can easily go around a farmer's market and still miss perhaps some of the vendors there. There's so much to take in, and so many different kinds of vendors. But all of those people come together with a common purpose, to sell local goods, to give an opportunity to purchase some products that have been prepared. And it gives an opportunity to the buyer to take advantage of these various things that have been prepared. As we turn to Leviticus this evening, we're turning to a very important chapter. It is a chapter on what it means to be holy. And that's one of the themes that we have been looking at throughout Leviticus, creating a holy people and what all that entails. But as we turn to this chapter this evening, you will have noticed how many commands are woven into this one chapter. And we could arguably take several weeks and just dissect this chapter. We could pull it apart and look at each of these commands for a long time, because there's so much embedded in this. But for our purposes this evening, we want to step back and to see what the overall impression is, that the people of God were to learn what it means to be holy. And to be holy means to be consecrated to the Lord in everything they do. That's something that we looked at, you remember, when we were looking at Colossians, how Paul, when he told the Colossians that they were to put off their old self and to put on the new self. And then he started talking about how their relationships were to change. Well, here's Leviticus saying to be holy now means that every aspect of your life is consecrated to the Lord's will. That everything you do now comes under the rubric of God's will in their life. And so we want to look at this chapter as a whole and thinking about that theme of what it means to be holy. And we want to see that because the Lord has redeemed his people unto holiness, that those who belong to the Lord are to be marked by holiness in all of life. We want to think about this chapter in two thoughts. We want to think about the basis for being holy. And then secondly, we want to think about the expression of holiness. First, we're thinking about the basis of what is being said. At the beginning of the chapter there, you notice that it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel." Throughout Leviticus, you'll have noticed that many times, most of Leviticus is actually direct speech. It is the Lord speaking. But oftentimes, the Lord is speaking through Moses to Aaron, or he is speaking from Moses to the priests. But here, the Lord is addressing specifically all the congregation of Israel. That the theme of holiness is not something that is relegated just to the priests, but being a holy nation is something that pertains to all of them. You remember that the Lord had purposed, they were his treasured possession, that he had bore them on eagle's wings, and that now they were to be a holy nation. But a holy nation doesn't just mean that they have God in their midst. Being a holy nation doesn't just mean that they had priests that were set apart as holy unto the Lord. Being a holy nation meant that each and every person was to be set apart to the Lord's will in their life. And so here at the beginning of this chapter, you notice that it is explicit that all of Israel is to take heed to what is being said here, that it is something that pertains to all of them. And they're not simply to say, that's the business of the priests. Rather, it is something that marks all of God's people. They are all to be holy. What does it mean when we say God is holy? What does it mean when we say that the people are holy? You remember in Isaiah has that vision where he sees the Lord high and lifted up, and the cherubim are saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." What does it mean when we say God is holy? The word for holy is a word, the root has the idea of separateness, to be at a distance from something. And so when we talk about holiness, oftentimes we have the idea of a separate from sin, to be consecrated or to be put at a distance from all that is displeasing in God's sight. But when we talk about holiness, and holiness is part of the character, the attributes of God, when we talk about God's attributes, God is holy, irregardless of creation. And God was holy even before sin was part of the picture. Sinclair Ferguson makes the point that when we talk about holiness, then, we don't just have to talk about it as separate from something. God's holiness is also a separation unto something positive. It means devotion. And when we talk about God being holy, it's the idea of God being devoted unto his own glory. That the Father is devoted unto the Son's glory. The Son is devoted unto the Father's glory. The Spirit is devoted unto the Christ's glory. But it is a delighting within the Godhead, a desire to see God's glory radiate over all things. And so God is opposed to anything that would be an attack on his glory. And so when we talk about the people being holy, it's not just saying separate from sin, but a holy people are to be a people that are devoted unto the glory of God themselves. And that is something that is woven into this very chapter. So when God commands the people to be holy, he is telling them to be devoted in every way of their life's experience. And this is the calling of every single person. But you notice in the opening verses here, the Lord gives something of a context for why he is commanding them to live this way. It says, "Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy.'" That little word, "your," is significant. Because what is it implying? It's implying a relationship. It's implying that God is a God who is in covenant with them. The Lord who has called them to live this way is the God who has already redeemed them. He is the God who has redeemed them from slavery. He is their Lord, and he has covenanted with his people. And now they are to live in a way that shows their belonging unto the Lord. Throughout this chapter, the Lord will again and again say, "I am the Lord," or "I am the Lord your God." 15 times it is going to use that phraseology, which is really just a shorthanded way of saying, "I am the Lord who has redeemed you, and you belong to me." And now the people are to show that relationship in the way that they treasure the Lord in their lifestyle. So Leviticus 19 is filled with commands. It might be like walking into a farmer's market where you see all kinds of things for sale. And it just feels like it's all packed together. But what Leviticus is saying is that as we come to think about the life of faith, we're saying, "I'm to be consecrated unto the Lord's will in all that I do." It's to shape all of life. And it's because the Lord has purchased and has redeemed me and has entered into a covenant with me. The second reason in which the Lord bases these commands is also there in verse 2. "For I, the Lord your God, am holy." God is telling the people to be something because he is something. He is telling them to mirror his character. He is telling his people that they are to be a reflection of what he is like. We are created, we say, in the image of God. We are meant to show forth and to function as God's vice regents on earth. We are meant to establish God's will. But God is telling his people here that you are to mirror my character. And so we can summarize that whole mission with the word holy. that we are to be those that show the character of God by the way that we live. And that is what Israel was being taught here. So we have the basis here. They are a people that have already been redeemed, a people who have been brought into covenant with God as a result of his gracious work, a people who are now tasked with the task of reflecting God's character in their life. But in the rest of this chapter, we are really given an expression of what holiness looks like in their life's experience. Not only are there many commands listed here, but Leviticus 19 jumps from topic to topic. It can really be hard to see the sequence of where we're going next. All kinds of topics are mentioned. And in many ways, it's kind of like the book of Proverbs. It's bringing together all of life into one. The sheer number, as we mentioned, the sheer number of commands here could warrant a more in-depth study. But we're simply wanting to take the overall impression this evening. But notice what it's stressing is that it's touching on every aspect of life, which can really rub us the wrong way as moderns ourselves. The modern life is one in which we have become accustomed to making a distinction between the public life and the private life, where we act in a certain capacity in public, but our faith is something that we relegate more to our private life, and where we think of our faith as more in the realm of a comfort, where you look for hope and comfort in this life. And we kind of relegate our faith to that category. But here the people of in Leviticus are being taught that your faith is not just something private. It is something that is to shape the way that you do your business. It is meant to shape the way that you treat your neighbor. It is really meant to shape the way that you worship. It is meant to shape the way that you treat your family. It's meant to shape the way that you treat the sojourner. That the way you live is showing what you believe. It's showing your faith in action. And so here, the people are seeing an integrated whole to how they live their lives. So far in Leviticus, holiness, we've thought of it in a very ritual way. We've talked about clean and unclean. We've talked about being pure and impure. We've thought about holiness as a ritual state. But as we come here to Leviticus, we begin to see that that was really preparing us for thinking about holiness on a moral level. That it's not just talking about ceremonies. Being holy means that we are acting in a way that is right in God's sight. We're doing what is approved by God in our behavior. And so here we're seeing holiness as a moral category. Now, do all of these commands apply to believers today? You remember we looked at last time the importance of always asking the question, what is the intended function of that command? And we highlighted that Christians down through the centuries have always understood there is a threefold distinction or division of the law. There is something that we call the ceremonial law. The ceremonies, like the animal sacrifices, were meant to teach the people in a preparatory way about the work that Jesus would fulfill. Those ceremonies have been fulfilled now in Christ, and they no longer are binding in the new covenant. There are the civil laws. Those civil laws really demarcated Israel from their surrounding nations. It helped Israel to be a marked out people, a people that lived distinct unto the Lord. Many of those laws were based on principles of the moral law, but their application was conditioned to the old covenant. But there were also what we called the moral law itself. And the moral law is a reflection of God's abiding character that is eternal, that was engraven in stone with the finger of God. That moral law is for all people in all places. And so that helps us as we come to passages like this. We're able to look at the laws and to understand what is the function that this law is communicating and to be able to understand, does it apply today? Is it a reflection of God's abiding character? Or is this something that was a preparation for Christ? Is this something that was demarcating the nation during the Old Covenant period? But in all ways, it helps us understand these different laws in navigating this chapter. But we want to look at different kinds of commands in this chapter, and we really want to look at five types of commands. There is first commands of holiness as it relates to the family. You see that in verse 3. Every one of you shall revere his mother and his father, being stressed at the beginning. These kinds of commands are also referenced later on. For instance, in verse 32, it says, "You shall stand up before the face of an old man, and the great you will stand." Not only was it appropriate to show humility before those who have experienced much in life, but it recognizes that as we age, we stand in need of even greater patience and care. To honor the elderly, then, shows care towards those who are disadvantaged. Parents, likewise, are to protect their children, and that is something as well that is stressed in this chapter. But what it is teaching us is that holiness is something that is worked into the family life. That parents are to take care of their children. And then as they age, children are to take care of their parents. But what is to mark the family is this idea of caring for one another. Of recognizing vulnerabilities and of being able to support and to protect one another. Another area in which we see holiness being lived out is not only in the family, but in worship itself. You see that in verses 5 through 8, for instance, where it gives correction about how the fellowship offerings were to be done. Suddenly we're being brought back to these sacrifices and the proper observance of them. But it's teaching the people how to be devoted to God even in the act of worship. Whose will establishes how they worship? They are to submit ultimately to what God has explicitly commanded. But more than that, notice if you go down to verse 19, it says, "You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material." Maybe you've had the experience of someone asking you what your shirt is made out of. And they might ask you, is it all made of one type of fabric? Or is your shirt made of more than one kind of fabric? And the purpose behind that question can oftentimes be intended to show, see, you Christians, you don't even follow the law yourselves. Again, you're picking and choosing. We have to first ask ourselves, why were the people of Israel forbidden from mixing fabrics? Why were they forbidden from mixing seeds? Why were they forbidden from mixing even cattle or kinds of cattle? And there have been different points made even about the natural order of things. But perhaps the most probable and persuasive argument for why Israel was being forbidden to mix is because the mixing was a sign of the sacred sphere. That mixing of things actually communicated something as being holy unto the Lord. Let me give you just three examples of that. For instance, in the Old Testament, we are told that heavenly beings are mixtures of creatures. If you read in Ezekiel chapter 1, the creatures that are described there are described in mixed senses. Secondly, a mixed crop in Deuteronomy is deemed holy and therefore to be given to the tabernacle. And thirdly, some priests' garments and the tabernacle curtains were made or composed of mixed fabrics. And so they are consecrated as holy. So when we begin to pause and to dissect, why is the mixing of fabrics being prohibited here to the people of Israel? The most logical or the most natural way of understanding it is because the mixing of fabrics, the mixing of seeds, the mixing of kinds is something that is set apart. It is something that demarcates it as holy unto the Lord, something that is part of the tabernacle ministry. And therefore, to make that line of demarcation, the people were not to do it themselves. A modern analogy might help. One person has compared it to, imagine if you go to a coffee shop or you go to the hospital and you see someone there at the table and they have a clerical collar on. You know that when you see someone with a clerical collar, that's a person from the clergy. That's someone that you can go to and that you can pour out your heart to. That's someone that you can talk to and pray with. But if you found out that the person wearing that clerical collar wasn't part of a clergy, they weren't part of a church, you would say something's wrong here. They blurred lines. They gave an indication of something, but they weren't that themselves. Or perhaps another example, when we think of in our own country, the example of someone purchasing a car and then decorating that car to make it appear as if it's an RCMP vehicle, when in fact it is not. It is actually blurring lines that prevent people from seeing the difference between those in authority and the regular citizen. Here, the people are learning that the sacred sphere or the tabernacle ministry is something that needs to be protected. And therefore, the people were being told not to mix as a result. So they're being given these commandments about worship in order that the Lord would be honored and God's order would be recognized. But there's other commands as well. You notice in verses 26 through 31, there are commands forbidding the participation in pagan worship practices, such as eating over blood or the cutting of the body. In fact, in verses 26 through 28, you'll see that there are seven prohibitions there. Six of them are clearly about pagan worship practices, and most likely the marking of the body could be included in that set as well. So all of this is teaching the people that their worship was not to take its cue from the practices around them, but rather according to God's commandments. You remember Elijah, when he has the contest with the prophets of Baal. How do the prophets of Baal call down Baal? They were cutting themselves. They were trying to invoke their idols by marking their own body. That's something that is prohibited to the people of Israel. But it's something that could be a temptation to Israel as they see other practices being done around them. So here Israel is learning that they are to worship the Lord, but they're also to worship the Lord according to God's commandments. Furthermore, they're prohibited from trying to make contact with the spirits of the dead. Instead, they are to rely on the living God to guide them. Syncretism is always a danger, and the people were to learn not to adopt everything that they saw around them. So they were to be holy in terms of the way that the family lived, caring for one another. They were to be holy in terms of their worship, devoted to what God has commanded and not to their own will. They were to be holy in terms of their business practices. You see that back in verses 9 and 10. It tells us, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. What that meant is that at least one edge of the field was to be left unharvested, that they were to leave a portion of the field. Farmers' mindset was not to be driven by selfish gain, maximizing profits. But the farmer was to realize that they were to care for the weakest and the most vulnerable people in their society. In a society that depended on the agriculture for food for the body, the farmers had the opportunity to care for those who were in danger of poverty. Neither were the people to steal or to act deceptively towards their neighbor by invoking God's name falsely. Neither were they to use unjust scales and so wrong their neighbor. All of this is emphasizing you take your faith into your work. You don't act one way on Sunday and then try to take advantage of and manipulate your neighbor on Monday. You are to do what is just, what is right, Farmers are to be recognized by their generosity. They are to be those that are graciously caring for their neighbor. The holiness is also to mark its way in the administration of justice, in the courts. You see that in verses 15 and 16. They were not to be partial to the poor, and neither were they to defer to the great. But in righteousness, they were to judge their neighbor. They weren't to give the rich a pass, in other words, in order to avoid the controversy. But instead, they were to be honoring what is right. Justice was to be upheld. And that's something that ideally we recognize. We expect people to be honest with us. But if we're sitting here this evening as someone who hasn't come to faith, why should people be honest? Why should people tell us the truth if there's no objective standard upon which they're held accountable to? The whole system of justice, the whole idea of people being honest, is built on the foundation that there is a judge, that there is a standard by which we are held accountable to. The people here were to recognize that they were to do what is right. They were to uphold justice and truth, even in the courts. Holiness was also to be something that shaped their social interactions and their relationships. It even mentions a scenario where a man lies sexually with a woman who is deemed a slave. The language of a slave here is misleading. Because when we hear the word slave, we think of chattel slavery. We're thinking of something very demeaning. Slavery in that sense was something prohibited in the Old Testament. Even in the Old Testament, the only practice was is that if a person couldn't pay off their financial loan, they could make themselves an indebted servant. But even that was only for 6 years. And then they were to be released. And if in any way they were abused, they were to be released. So a servant still had their rights. They were still treated with dignity, even as they paid off their loans. But in this situation, there is a relationship where someone is an indebted servant. But instead of them being punished, there is a way in which they can correct the wrong that has happened. The man was expected to marry and to care for the woman rather than leaving her in a vulnerable position of being forsaken and uncared for in that society. But he was to give one of the greatest offerings, showing the costliness and his acknowledgement of the wrongfulness of his actions. So there is a holiness that is correcting the wrongs that have been committed in social interactions. But at the heart of this chapter is holiness as it relates to our neighbor. You see that in verses 17 and 18. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. You'll notice that this command is given in the context of being wronged by another person. But the people of Israel are actually given 6 instructions about what to do when you've been wronged by someone. The first is that they're not to hate them. They're not to hate their neighbor. Rather, they are to show love towards them. Goes on, he says, not only are they not to hate their fellow Israelite, but they are allowed to reprove them. They are allowed to correct. They are allowed to set things correctly. They are not to do any wrong to their neighbor, and they must not take vengeance on them. They are not to maintain a hostility towards them, holding a grudge towards them, but rather they must love their neighbor as themselves. And then you come to the New Testament. And when Jesus is teaching the Sermon on the Mount, what does Jesus teach? He says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall love your neighbor, and your enemy who hates you, you shall pray for. Well, then Jesus says, and so you shall be sons of your Father in heaven. That's the key. Jesus is saying that we are to love our neighbors. But the motive behind it is that it is a reflection of the character of God. That's what Leviticus is arguing. The people are to act in such a way that reveals and reflects God's character. They're to be holy. What does that mean? It means they're to be caring, as a father cares for his children, and as children care for their aging parents. It means that they're to be just as the civil courts are to not allow the rich to have a pass, so the courts are to uphold justice because God is just. They are to be marked by a sense of mercy towards others, just as a farmer would leave portions of the field in order for those who were impoverished to be able to be fed. The people are to act in such a way, not just to hold up these ideals, but because these ideals reflect who God is himself. And Jesus was stressing that even in the Sermon on the Mount. All of these commands show us what we are expected to be. But as we look at them, we begin to see where we fall short, where hatred for our neighbor begins to set in, where we do hold grudges against other people, where we have suppressed the truth rather than upheld the truth, where we haven't been generous when we've had opportunities to be generous, where we have neglected other people rather than caring for them in the opportunities given to us. But what Jesus here is stressing is that his disciples are to live this way as a result of coming to know God. Remember when Isaiah said that he saw the Lord high and lifted up? Jesus says that when Isaiah saw that, he saw him. That he saw Jesus. But then throughout the rest of Isaiah's prophecy, he always is describing God as the Holy One of Israel. Seeing the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ transformed Isaiah. That now he is thinking about God as holy. And it shapes him. When we come to see the glory of God, it's meant to shape and to transform us. That Jesus came into this world to save sinners. That Jesus came into this world to express the compassion and the forgiveness, the mercy of God. All of these commands are a reflection of God's character as compassionate and just and forgiving. We see that all being fulfilled in the Lord Jesus, who unveils the Lord's holiness. God shows his love towards us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The love of God towards sinners is what changes the way that we live. And we begin to see Leviticus in all its depth. Because Leviticus is saying, this is how you are meant to live. And when we begin to see the standard, we see how we fall short. But then Leviticus is also showing a people who have been shaped by God's grace, how they respond as well. Those who have come to see the holiness of God become holy. Those who have seen the glory of God in Christ begin to reflect Christ. Those who have come to see that God has been compassionate towards them and their sins become compassionate. Those who see that God has been generous in giving his only begotten Son become generous. Those who have seen the justice of God at the cross become concerned about justice and truth. It shapes them. The people of Israel were to learn what you believe is to shape the way that you live. The people of Israel were to learn, be holy, because your God is holy. And you remember, we were reading there in 1 Peter. Peter says to the New Covenant Church, you are to be holy, because your God is holy. You have come to discover God's grace in Jesus Christ, who was written of by the prophets. You have come to see God's mercy, and that is to transform the way that we live. So as we think about this exhortation, be holy, for the Lord your God is holy. The people of God are to reflect God's character. Compassion, justice, generosity, caring, merciful. That happens as we come to behold God's glory in Christ. Then they begin to live in a different way. Have we come to see the holiness of God as He reveals Himself in Jesus Christ? Have we come to realize what God desires of His people?